A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know, Korn, this whole show runs on GPU compute, and we wouldn't be here without Modal.
Seriously. And that's what powers all our text-to-speech. Everything you're hearing right now.
They're an AI infrastructure platform. Developers use them to run GPU workloads in the cloud with zero infrastructure headache.
If you're building anything with AI, check them out. Modal.com. France's Prime Minister just threw a very public temper tantrum last month after Moody's cut their rating, called them irresponsible and detached from reality, demanded a meeting with their analysts. It was a whole spectacle.
Right, March 2026. They dropped France from AA2 to AA3. And this wasn't some sleepy finance ministry press release. The political reaction was immediate and furious. I mean, they didn't just issue a rebuttal, they summoned the local Moody's representatives for a dressing down that leaked to every major paper. It was a deliberate political strategy to frame the narrative.
Which gets at the core tension here. These rating agencies, Moody's, S&P, Fitch, they hand out these letter grades that dictate how much it costs a country to borrow money. That affects everything from building highways to funding pensions. But the French reaction asks a deeper question. Who are these unelected entities to make such a consequential judgment?
So when Daniel sends us a prompt about what actually goes into these changes and who they really hurt, it's not just academic. It's about power, perception, and the plumbing of the global financial system.
Okay, here's what he wrote. He wants us to explore credit rating changes for countries. Key questions. 1. What information and due diligence typically precede a change? 2. How seriously does the market take these rating changes, and who's most affected? 3. What's the practical impact of a specific move, say from B+ down to B-? And 4. What are the likely after effects? So, the whole life cycle of a downgrade.
By the way, for the listeners, today's script is being powered by DeepSeek V3.2.
The friendly AI down the road is on form today, I see.
And this is a great topic because most of the headlines just scream downshock or upgrade surprise without ever explaining the machinery behind it. France's reaction is a perfect hook. It shows these aren't just report cards. They're market-moving geopolitical events. They're a form of soft power wielded from private boardrooms.
Where do we even start with this? The backlash suggests countries feel these decisions are both powerful and, in their view, arbitrary. But is that fair? Or is there a rigorous, if flawed, process?
Let's start with the basics, but we'll keep it quick. Sovereign credit ratings are essentially a risk score for a country's debt. Can they pay us back? If so, how likely is it? The Big Three's agencies have a near monopoly on this. Their verdicts determine access to capital markets for most of the world. It's a bit like having only 3 companies that can certify the safety of all the airplanes in the sky. Their stamp is mandatory for takeoff.
The scale runs from the pristine AAA down through various Bs and Cs, all the way to default. But it's not a smooth slope, is it? There are specific cliffs along the way.
As of this year, only 11 countries hold Moody's highest AA rating. That's down from 15 just 6 years ago. The club is shrinking. Germany, Switzerland, Singapore, a handful of others. And that exclusivity matters because it sets the benchmark for everything else.
The pressure is real. When a finance minister wakes up to a downgrade, they're not just looking at bruised pride. They're looking at potentially billions in higher interest payments over the next decade. But what does that actually look like in a budget? Is it abstract? Or can you point to a specific program that gets cut?
Oh, it's painfully concrete. Let's say a downgrade adds 50 basis points to your borrowing costs. On a national debt stock of, say, 2 trillion euros, that's an extra 10 billion euros in annual interest payments. That's the equivalent of a major national infrastructure program or a chunk of the education budget, gone, just to serve as higher costs. That's why the French reaction, while theatrical, was rooted in a real economic threat. They see their borrowing costs going up because of a judgment call made in a New York office tower.
How do these agencies actually decide when to pull the downgrade lever? Let's open the black box. Is it a button you push, or a long, deliberative process?
It's a process that's part science, part dark art, and it usually starts long before the headlines. The science part is the framework they all use, more or less. A sovereign credit rating is an assessment of the risk that a government will default on its local or foreign currency debt obligations. But default itself is a spectrum. It could be a hard stop on payments, a forced restructuring where creditors take a haircut, or even a coercive swap of old debt for new, less valuable debt.
It's a global IOU score, but one that has to account for legal finesse and political maneuvering.
And it signals to investors, particularly the massive institutional ones, the likelihood they'll get their money back with interest. For pension funds or insurance companies that are legally required to hold only investment-grade assets, that letter grade is a binary gatekeeper. No triple B minus, no entry. It's a regulatory on-off switch.
The market dominance you mentioned is staggering. Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and Fitch control something like 95% of the global rating business. Their logos on a research report carry an outsized weight that no boutique firm can match. How did they get that entrenched? Was it always this way?
It's a certified oligopoly, built on decades of being embedded in financial regulations and index constructions. After the Great Depression, and then more formally after the 1970s, regulators worldwide started using these ratings to define what counted as a safe asset for banks and insurers. That created a network effect. When they speak, the market has to listen because so many investment rules are written around their ratings. A downgrade isn't just an opinion. For many funds, it's a forced selling trigger. It's a self-reinforcing loop of authority.
Which brings us back to the dark art. If it's just math, why the fury? What's in the secret sauce? There must be a moment where human judgment overrides the spreadsheet.
Because the final grade isn't just a spreadsheet output. It's a committee decision based on both quantifiable data and qualitative, forward-looking judgments about politics, institutional strength, and geopolitical risk. That's where the controversy always lives, in those subjective calls. The numbers tell you what hasn't happened. The committee is trying to guess what will happen, and that's inherently messy.
Wait. So they sit in a room and decide a country's fate based on, what, a vibe check? How do you even begin to standardize a judgment on political stability?
Not just a vibe, but yes, judgment calls are central. They use structured frameworks for these qualitative factors, but they're still judgments. Let's walk through the typical process. An analyst team, usually 3 to 5 people, is assigned to a country or region. They start with the hard numbers, GDP growth forecasts, debt-to-GDP ratio, the size of foreign currency reserves, inflation, the current account balance. They'll have access to non-public data too, from trade flows monitored by banks to private estimates of tax collection.
The usual macroeconomic dashboard, but with some premium feeds.
But then they layer on the qualitative assessments. They look at institutional strength. How effective is the central bank? How stable is the legal system? They assess fiscal policy management, which is inherently political. And then there's geopolitical risk, which is getting heavier weight every year. Think about the gray zone rating. Some agencies gave Russia just before the invasion of Ukraine, a clear signal that qualitative geopolitical risk was overwhelming the otherwise decent-looking fiscal numbers at the time.
At a certain point, the subjective can override the objective. But how much? Can a bad feeling about a parliament cancel out 3 years of solid GDP growth?
Often, yes. If that feeling points to a future derailment, the agencies also use proprietary models to crunch these variables. Moody's has its GRI, or government-related issuer, model for sovereign risk. It spits out a suggested rating based on the inputs. But here's the key part. That model output is just a starting point, a conversation opener for the committee.
How much can they move from it? Is there a limit to the committee's discretion?
Typically, the committee can adjust the final rating by 1 to 3 notches from the model suggestion, based on those qualitative factors. So if the model says BB, the committee could decide on a B+ based on, say, a deteriorating political outlook that the numbers haven't captured yet. This is why they're often accused of being pro-cyclical. They're incorporating market sentiment and current crises into their forward look, which can amplify trends.
Meaning they kick you when you're down. In a recession, tax revenues fall, deficits rise, the model says downgrade, and the committee, seeing social unrest, agrees and downgrades even further.
In a crisis, the numbers get worse, political instability rises, and the qualitative judgment turns negative. The committee sees both arrows pointing down, so they downgrade. This can make borrowing more expensive right when a country needs liquidity most, creating a vicious cycle. We saw this clearly in Ghana's downgrade in late 2023. It's a classic case study in the pro-cyclical trap.
From B- to triple C+, right? A plunge into deep junk territory.
Their debt to GDP had ballooned past 90%, inflation was soaring, and negotiations for an IMF program were stalling. The model said junk, and the committee agreed, pushing it further into speculative grade. That immediately triggered selling from funds that can't hold anything below triple B-. So the process took a fragile situation and added a layer of mechanical, forced selling pressure on top of it.
The process takes a bad situation and codifies it into a market penalty. It becomes an official stamp of distress. But how long does this whole review take? Is it weeks? Months?
It formalizes the risk, yes. The review itself isn't quick either. It's not a snap judgment. Take Argentina's downgrade to triple C's in 2024. That followed a six-month review process after their latest debt restructuring attempt fell apart. The analysts were tracking reserve depletion, capital flight, and the legislative stalemate for half a year before pulling the trigger. They're constantly monitoring, but a formal review leading to a change is a deliberate, multi-step process.
During that time, the market is already pricing in the likely outcome. Bond traders aren't waiting for the press release.
Which is why sometimes the actual downgrade day is a non-event. The damage is done during the negative watch period when everyone is anticipating it. The opposite happened with Vietnam in 2025. They got an upgrade from BBs to BB+ after 18 months of consistent structural reforms and strong export growth. The analysts had been on positive outlook for a year, telegraphing the move. By the time the upgrade came, the yield on Vietnamese bonds had already compressed significantly.
The real signal is often in the outlook, not the rating change itself. The headline is the confirmation, not the news. That's a critical distinction.
100%. The shadow reports and internal committee debates are where the action is. Agencies constantly produce internal assessments that never see the light of day, updating their risk models with non-public data from banks and trade flows. An analyst's discretionary call on, say, whether a new finance minister is credible, can tilt the scales. There's a fascinating, if apocryphal, story about a key S&P analyst in the early 2010s whose personal assessment of a European finance minister's communication skills during a crisis call reportedly influenced the margin of a downgrade.
Which brings us back to France. Their prime minister wasn't mad at a spreadsheet. He was mad at a committee's judgment that his political coalition couldn't get the deficit under control. He was mad at a story they were telling about his government's future.
The numbers showed a rising debt trajectory, but the downgrade ultimately rested on a qualitative assessment of political will and policy effectiveness. That's what he called detached from reality, the reality versus his. It's the eternal tension between the quantifiable past and the uncertain future. And once that judgment is made, the committee votes, the press release goes out, and the finance minister fumes. But then the machinery of the market engages, and that's where the real consequences unfold.
Right. And then the real question is, what happens next in the markets? How much does a single notch really cost? We hear basis points, but let's make that tangible.
That's where the rubber meets the road. A one-notch downgrade, say from B+ to B, typically increases a country's bond, yields by 30 to 50 basis points, according to IMF data from 2025. That's a concrete, quantifiable penalty. But it's not uniform. For a large, liquid market like France, the impact might be at the lower end, maybe 25 basis points, because there's so much investor depth. For a smaller, less liquid issuer, it could be 70.
On a billion-dollar bond issuance, that's an extra $3 to $5 million a year in interest payments. Suddenly, the Prime Minister's anger looks a little more pragmatic. That's real money leaving the Treasury for bondholders.
And that's the average. For a country already on the edge, the jump can be much steeper. If you fall from B+ down to B-, which is two notches, that yield spike can be 100 to 150 basis points. That's a massive shift in affordability. It immediately shrinks the pool of willing lenders. And it's not just new debt. It reprices your entire existing stock of floating rate debt and sets a higher benchmark for when you need to roll over maturing bonds.
Because not everyone is allowed to buy that debt anymore. The investor base fundamentally changes.
This gets to who's most affected. The biggest, most rule-bound players are the ones who get forced out. Think massive public pension funds, insurance companies, certain index tracking funds. Their investment mandates often have strict clauses. Thou shalt not hold bonds rated below BBB-. These rules were written for prudence, but they create a mechanistic herd behavior.
Investment grade versus junk. The great divide. It's like a financial caste system.
The great cliff. Once you slip below that line, it triggers automatic, programmed selling. It's not a discretionary, we're worried. It's a, our charter says, we must sell within 30 days. This creates a predictable wave of selling pressure right after a downgrade crosses that threshold. Brazil's experience this year is a textbook case of the cliff effect in action.
They got cut to junk in 2026. What was the immediate mechanical fallout?
Yes, and it triggered an estimated $7 billion in automatic sell orders from funds that track major bond indices, because those indices, like the Bloomberg Barclays Global Aggregate, ejected Brazilian debt upon the downgrade. That's $7 billion of forced, non-discretionary selling hitting the market at once. It mechanically drives prices down and yields up, regardless of anyone's fundamental view on Brazil. Some passive fund managers literally had to sell at any price to match the index.
The initial market impact isn't just about new opinion. It's about mechanical rebalancing. It's a fire sale by algorithm. But doesn't that create an opportunity for someone else?
A huge part of it is. Now, on the other side, you have players who see this as an opportunity. Hedge funds, distressed debt specialists, some active managers. They aren't bound by those rules. They might see the forced selling as creating a bargain, a price dislocation. They'll step in to buy, hoping the market has overreacted to the rating change itself. But they're buying at a discount, demanding a much higher yield for the perceived risk, which locks in the higher borrowing cost for the country.
The vultures circle, or the contrarians pounce, depending on your perspective. But their presence doesn't bring the yield back down to pre-downgrade levels. It just establishes a new, higher equilibrium.
So the immediate aftermath is a tug-of-war between forced sellers and opportunistic buyers. The net effect on yields depends on which side has more firepower. Usually, the forced sellers win in the short term because their selling is immediate and inelastic. The buyers can take their time waiting for the price to fall even further. This often results in an overshoot, where yields spike higher than the new fundamental risk might justify, before settling back a bit.
This gets even messier with derivatives, doesn't it? The hidden wiring of the financial system.
That's the knock-on effect, and it can amplify everything. Credit default swaps, CDS contracts, many of these derivatives have rating triggers built into them. If a country's rating drops past a certain point, it can trigger collateral calls or even accelerate payments. It's like a ripple effect in a complex web.
If I bought insurance on Brazilian debt via CDS, what happens when Brazil is downgraded to junk?
If you bought a CDS, you're essentially paying a premium for protection against a default. The contract terms often say that if the underlying debt gets downgraded into junk, the party selling you the protection, the insurer, might have to post more collateral with a clearinghouse to back their promise. That can cause a liquidity scramble. Or, in some older contracts, a downgrade could be deemed a credit event itself, allowing the protection buyer to demand a payout early. These triggers can force additional, unexpected selling in unrelated parts of the market as firms scramble for cash to meet these obligations.
A downgrade in Brazil can cause a hedge fund in London to sell stocks in Germany to meet a margin call it didn't expect. The contagion is wired into the system through these contractual linkages.
It's a systemic amplifier. The rating isn't just a grade, it's a trigger embedded in thousands of financial contracts globally. That's why the agencies wield such power. They're not just commentators, they're pulling Lee.
This episode was produced using DeepSeek V3.2. Text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weirding.